We are here in Dan Morgan's living room. No, but that's what you want it to have the feel of. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. I kind of like people to feel at home here.
And it's a bookstore in Prague. What part of Prague?
It's in Prague 6. It's kind of a turn of the century neighborhood. It was all fields in the 1880s, 1890s, and was very quickly built up from about 1900 to 1920.
Yeah, and it's easy to get to. It's like 15 minutes, if that, on the superb public transportation here, the tram.
Yeah, right from the center. Yeah, and it's also a nice walk, like a 20-minute walk down to the center. You've got actually the Prague Castle is very close to Prague 6. And you also have the Russian embassy, which is really interesting because you have a lot of Russian-speaking people living in this neighborhood. You often hear Russian on the buses, and there's also a nice mix of the expat community and Czechs. So yeah, I've always wanted to have a bookstore in this specific neighborhood.
Okay, so what took you to Prague in the first place?
Well, I was working as a landscaper in France, and I met my wife. She was visiting France, and we were in Antibes, at Cap d'Antibes. And so we met. She invited me to come to Prague. I thought, oh, that sounds really interesting. So when the season ended, I gave my notice and came to Prague and found a job, as so many Americans did in the early and mid-90s, teaching English.
And you obviously stayed then.
Yeah, my wife had invited me originally for 2 weeks, and she wasn't my wife at the time. We got married 4 years later, and stayed. I was teaching for through the mid-90s, and then I got a job at the Czech Press Agency, translating and proofreading around the year 2000. I was a freelance translator, and I got into books at around, oh, I think like around 2008.
And what does that mean?
Well, that means that I was living up in another area of Prague 6, and there was a used bookstore across the street from my flat. It was called Český antiquariat, which is basically Czech used books. And they're only open one day a week in the afternoon. It was run by the Termals. It was at that time it was just Mrs. Termalova who was running the business. Yeah, so I went in there, and she was very kind and started to realize that I had an interest in books, and she introduced me to Czech modernist book design, woodcuts by Czechs like Josef Vachal, and so it was really pleasurable for me to get this in through someone who was so knowledgeable. Yeah, so I started my own meager collection through her. I started as a collector.
You come by it honestly.
Yeah. Then they closed up about 5 years ago. Mrs. Termalova passed away. Just by chance, recently, I saw her daughter outside of the closed up bookstore. They still had all the books in it, and I asked her what was going to happen to the books, and she said, "Oh, it's too bad, but I just missed out because she'd arranged for somebody to come buy all the books up." But she took my number just in case it fell through, and just last month, she called me that it fell through, and I went up, and I actually bought the entire stock of Mrs. Termalova's bookstore, the first bookstore that actually began my interest in Czech books. So I feel like it was meant to be.
Yeah, it really is. Well, coming full circle, there's a lovely karma to it. What did she have that excited you the most then?
She had a very small bookshop, but they had an incredible collection, and they had run an auction since the early 90s, the Termals. So in their bookstore, they didn't have their top items, but they had great, just a great overview of books from before the revolution, from the First Republic.
Where are those dates?
The First Republic is from the founding of Czechoslovakia in 1918 to the Nazi occupation in 1939. She also started my interest in Samizdat, which was the illegal publications during the communist years. And that was fascinating for me. And also my wife is an art theoretician who deals in this area of kind of illegal performance art of the 1970s. So our interests kind of overlapped, and I was able to kind of find an area of interest within these illegally published magazines.
There's nothing really special about them, is there? I mean, there's no production value. It's just like typewritten things that are handed around, right?
Yeah. It's just pamphlets, and that's how it would work. It was you would get from your friend, somebody you could trust. You would get maybe a typed translation of Orwell's 1984, and you could have it for a week. And the price of being lent this was that you were to make two more copies and to return the copy with one of your copies, so that it could be spread to more people.
So it wasn't their own work, or was it?
Well, yeah, there's two types of samizdat. Yeah, there was the samizdat, which was illegal publications from abroad and from Czech writers. But the samizdat publishers here were quite active. There was a number, especially in the 1970s, a number of illicit operations that were producing, within the possibilities, quite quality works by Czech artists, by Czech writers. Ludwig Vasilík was probably the one who spearheaded this operation the most. He was in the late 70s. He was just indefatigable creator of Czech samizdat. And actually, just to get off of the for a moment, this is one of the great things about starting this bookstore, because you know, Nigel, that I've tried to also have these cultural evenings.
Yeah.
And the first cultural evening, we showed a screening of this film, Fighter. One of the characters was the Czech writer Arnoš Lustig. And one of the people that came to look at the film was this elderly Swedish man. And I just got talking to him. I was just, you know, so how are you enjoying Prague? And he's like, oh yeah, I was here. I've been here a number of times. Even I was here in the 70s. And I was like, wait a minute, who are you? And he was actually involved with smuggling these samizdat works in and out of the country. Yeah. And so I heard his story. And
how did he hear about your evening?
Keith Jones,
oh, yes.
Who knows everybody, yes, from these generations, brought him here. So Keith has been great for that.
Why is that exactly what you want then?
What I want, I want this to be an interesting cultural space, and I want these stories. That's also the thing about moving from being just like an online dealer to having a space, is you end up hearing so many stories that you would never have been privy to. You know, I'm going on book runs where I've put my number in a local paper, and you go to these people's houses, and, you know, they're looking to sell their libraries, and you sit down with these people, most of them who are like between the ages of 70 and 90, and they want to tell their stories. They tell the stories of how they got the books, and they tell their stories of, like, you know, just basically their stories of the 20th century, and they're just fascinating. I got a call from this former professor here at the Czech Technical University who was beside himself because his children didn't want his libraries, so it was, he wanted me to come take a look at it, and he had a great library for reading, but it was nothing I wanted. But we were sitting down next to his bookshelves, and he was telling me about, you know, he was born in the early 1930s, and at one point he reaches over and he points to a book, and it's Gone with the Wind, a Czech translation from the mid-40s, and he said, I was reading this book as a 9-year-old when my father was taken for interrogations by the communists, and I never saw him again. That was just, you know,
yeah,
such a powerful experience, which I would never, you know, as an online buyer, which I was 10 years before this, I would never have been, never heard these stories. I mean, this is like history that you're present at, listening to these stories.
Yeah, that's one of the aspects of being a, well, you still would have gotten that though, because you want to buy books for your online store as well as your regular store.
Right.
Right, but you weren't going out seeking stuff from real people at their houses, is that
yeah,
it?
That's it. I was sending money to their bank account. And basically everything I have here is what I have online. I don't have, I have a small storage area where I have all of Mrs. Termalova's books, and I haven't gone through them, but everything I've bought that hasn't been sold from the past 10 years is in this space now.
So the Samizdat, you just kind of go around to various bookstores and find this stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's basically like, you know, typewritten, an essay.
It's a varying quality, but there's some fascinating things there. I mean, a lot of the Samizdat is about like the music scene, it's about the art scene, it's about, there's budding poets, which doesn't interest me that much. Mm. I mean, I very much like the Samizdat that it kind of informs about a certain group of people and what they were trying to do, and you know how they were trying to uphold this cultural program that was not approved by the officials, and that fascinates me.
Why?
Well, because a lot of it is still not recorded in, you know, in as official history, so you can find out certain things that you'd never heard before through these publications. So these people who were important actors. Actually, there just came out a great book on the Czech Samizdat from 2018. It hasn't been translated to English, but absolutely amazing overview of it. I have it right over there.
And you can still find this by walking into a used bookstore.
Yeah.
Because again, it looks like nothing that you'd really anyone would want.
No, I mean, that's the magic of it, is that often you'll find it in stacks of magazines that nobody wants. Yeah. Although, it's also available online, and there are a lot of people who know its value, and they'll
right.
kind of like know that that's the direction, that's one of the directions the collection is going now.
Into Samizdat particularly, or what?
Yeah, there are a lot of collectors, I know a number of collectors who focus on Samizdat and these pamphlets. You know,
it's a nice compliment to getting, once they've you know, gone through all of this, they start publishing actual books, right? So you can kind of trace it all the way back.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what this, I think it's Mikhail Pshibram's book does. It traces the history of Samizdat in this country, and it's a great field to be into here, because you know it's not expensive. And as a collector, you can also, if you know what you're looking for, you can amass a decent collection without having to take out a loan.
But that isn't really your focus these days, or is it your specialty?
Well, it's one of my focus. It's actually one of the areas I find the most fascinating and the most informative for me. But as you know, I my focus is still avant-garde book design. Modernist book design, and that's what I have a small exhibition here now on the book design of Otakar Merkvichka from 1920 to about 1930, focusing on his photomontage and constructivist works.
Yeah, so maybe what you can do is get to the root or the beginning of the look of these magazines and books that were designed in the 20s and 30s here. You know, there's so many isms, yeah. Dadaism and constructivism and formalism and symbolism, but cubism really, and I'll quote Philip Cooper in his book on cubism published by Faden. Well, back in 1995, he said, cubism constitutes the greatest upheaval in art since the Renaissance. The artist was no longer obliged to depict objects naturalistically, but was also influenced by his mental conception of them. Traditional perspective was abandoned, and objects were often splayed out to show them from several viewpoints, and only a few defining details might be included. For example, a button to indicate clothing or a mustache to suggest a man's head. Further, greater freedom was allowed than before in manipulating the subject matter to unify the composition. The elements in a picture might be chosen and placed purely according to aesthetic considerations rather than being firmly based on reality. So what do you think about that?
Well, that was a major moment, obviously, in Czech art, embracing of cubism, especially from Paris. In Czech book design, which is my area, it was this period from World War I to about 1920 was marked by the young generation's movement away from secessionism, from Art Nouveau, and searching for a new style of book design. This was led by people like Josef Čapek and Karol Tyga, and the line to Paris, to Cubist painting was quite strong. This embracing, this trying to get away from the old Czech art. And so you have this movement of what is called the angular style in Czech book design or Cubist book design. Jindřich Toman wrote a great monograph on this, published about, I think about 10 years ago, where he mapped this explosive time in Czech book design. And so you have like, it actually ran in parallel with this architectural style called Cubism or Rondo Cubism, which was actually a specialty here in Prague. And so you have it, you actually see quite abrupt movement from this away from Art Nouveau at this time. And book designs from like 1918 to like 1921, they really went for this Cubist design, and they're really quite striking and unique. You don't, as far as I know, you don't find it in other countries. It was really quite this homegrown Czech style, and it laid the groundwork for modernist book design, I believe, like this idea of and even this idea of getting away from the flowery ornamental and going towards something much more striking, much more visually like a poster for the book.
First of all, you think that Czech book design was out front of everyone else?
I don't know enough about the European book designs of like the parallel movements. I will say that I do think that the Cubist book design by Czechs is a unique homegrown movement. I think that the later modernist design by people like Ladislav Sutnar was very much influenced by Bauhaus and by the Dutch. But you have a figure named an artist named Karol Tyga, who I think Tyga did more for Czech book design in these early years, and getting the young book designers to completely abandon secessionism than anyone else. And he was radical.
Can you define secessionism?
Art Nouveau.
Yeah. This ornate, flowery.
Yeah.
Beautiful, but kind of traditional, staid. It's like this sort of, with Cubism, this sort of fragmentation, almost explosion of like blowing that stuff up.
That's
literally.
That's a good way to put it, I think. It was. And also, I think with the secessionist book designs, a lot of the time the ornaments didn't really have that much to do with the theme of the book. With this, the Cubist book design was very much meant for like this young literature. This like to show that this kind of like this explosion of ideas, and also you had certain thematical ties with what was in the poetry, like with Apollinaire's poetry or with these up and coming proletarian writers. So you had a much more like visually striking, but at the same time attached to the content of the book, some kind of visual.
There was, well, with the cubism, there was a lot of punning and wordplay. I mean, they actually took pieces of newspaper and stuck it onto the surface, right? And this whole idea of collage and montage, it all comes out of Picasso originally, his work.
That's, yeah, and that's, we're getting now into the, like, 1923, 24, where Taiga and his fellow members of Debiut, so the group of young progressive artists right around 19, it was founded around 1920, they then started moving into this collage and photomontage. And so I think the new word, the new catchphrase for this was poetism. And they were using collage, they were using these textual inserts in also in the image to sort of generate these ideas of movement, of excitement, of the excitement for the modern world, for technology, for exotic places and travel. And it's amazing because it's just a few years after cubism, but cubist book design, I mean, I'm talking about cubist, the angler style now, it stopped quite abruptly. And you had, like, from 1923, 24, this real movement to this, what you're talking about, the collage.
But this is what Picasso was doing, maybe 15 years earlier, let's say. It's an interesting relationship between real artists and artists who may have another agenda, who are using these techniques to get a message across.
That's thanks to Carol Taiga, who was he spoke fluent French. He was translating from French. He was going to Paris on a regular basis, and he was a jack of all trades. He was painting in the early 20s. He was writing these theoretical texts. He was making woodcuts. He was making illustrations for books. He was designing covers. He was doing everything. But
typography.
Yeah. And also, of course, that's, how can I leave that out? The typography.
Yeah.
As you saw in Ebbe Seda, very like strikingly new.
Yeah, you should maybe talk quickly about that. That's an ABC book, but it's...
So I consider that as like the holy grail of Czech modernist typography. So you had the modernist experimental typography of Karel Taiga with the modernist dance images of this wonderful dancer named Milce Majerova, combined with the modernist verse of another Debiutsil member, Vyacheslav Nezval, who is also pushing poetry and embracing sort of French experimental poetry at the time and trying to like move Czech poetry in that direction. I just can't get over how beautiful that book is.
It's a dancer who's forming the shapes of the letters of the alphabet.
That's right. So it's almost like an homage to the alphabet in this modernist style of poetry, and Milce Majerova in each page is expressing her feeling of the letter. Everybody knows this book. This is, I think, most of the institutions around the world have found a copy of this book. There were 1,000 copies printed, so it wasn't a huge print run, but it's worth having.
So, Taiga, did he know Picasso?
I don't think so. No. Taiga was he was 20 years old in 1920, so he was a little bit younger, maybe 20 years younger than Picasso. But he ended up forming a strong relationship with André Breton, especially in the later 1930s.
Yeah.
Who did he know in the early 1920s in Paris? I'm not sure. He was also publishing magazines and getting all of the magazines, the avant-garde magazines from Paris. And so
you translated a book on him.
I translated part of the book with the strange title, Carol Taiga, Captain of the Avant-Garde. Almost sounds like a superhero, but I guess it's
certainly as energetic as one.
Oh, he was in every single area of the arts, and he was just amazingly bold for, you know, he's 20 years old, and he was going against this older Czech guard, which was very strong, very conservative, and he'd have...
Mucha would he'd be part of that, right? The sort of Art Nouveau posters and such.
Yeah, yeah, he was more of the secessionist period, and so that was what Taiga was fighting against.
And Taiga was connected to the Bauhaus. Did he teach there? Or?
No, he didn't. As far as I know, he didn't.
But again, he knew what they were doing, and he was practicing.
Yes, he knew what they were doing. He was, I'm sure, he was in contact. Also, of course, he was a theoretician of architecture, so he was in close contact with the German architects. And
yeah. So it sounds like almost like he's, and maybe this explains why Czech book design and magazine design of the 20s and 30s and 40s is so out front, because he pulled all sorts of interesting things together from Germany and France and brought it back to Prague.
I think without Karel Taiga, there would have been a much different modernist movement. I mean, there were also very strong other artists who were doing a lot to completely change the appearance of Czech book. As I mentioned, Ladislav Sutnar. And even though that they had their different communities, Sutnar wasn't really a part of the Debreceni community, he was much admired by Taiga. And so they had a deep mutual respect. But you can see that Sutnar had a, even from the like mid-1920s, he had a slightly cleaner aesthetic idea of book design.
What do you mean by that?
Well, just sort of like this less crowded. Sutnar wasn't really into like the photo montage, the collage, as much as Taiga. And so he was going for this more, I would say, Bauhaus-influenced, maybe slightly more minimalist approach to modernist design.
Yeah, because Czech book design is really important. And we're trying to get at why, and why it's led the world in that period. And it seems like it was these brilliant personalities and practitioners that kind of bounced off each other here, maybe more than elsewhere.
I don't know if I would say leading the world, but for a small country, it had extremely strong response to modern art and to integrate it into book design. But there's been so many of these monographs written by people like Ingrid Toman. And so I think thanks to these monographs, like there's one on Josef Čapek's design, there's one on Czech angular style or cubist style that we talked about.
Is he from Michigan University?
Yeah, he teaches. I think he taught out there. I think that's right. And what else? Oh, photomontage. His book on photomontage just so beautifully maps this whole movement from about 19. I think it really catches on in like 1925 to 1950.
And how did the world find out about this stuff then? Was it, were there some sort of influential exhibitions that took place that these works were shown at, that been sort of spread out throughout the world? Or was it just maybe it was emigration? What was it?
No, I think it was after the revolution. I know that MIT came out with a number of books, published a number of books on Czech avant-garde design, Czech art, on Karel Taiga. Karel Taiga was very much rediscovered after the revolution.
You mean like 89, 90?
Yeah, okay. Sorry, over the revolution.
But what about at the time that they were producing it in the 20s and 30s? How did that influence the rest of the world, or did it?
Well, I think that André Breton was a major voice for the quality of Czech art, and I'm sure there are a lot more. But it was also, I mean, this avant-garde movement wasn't, in the 50 years or the 40 years leading up to the Velvet Revolution, there weren't that many exhibitions about it. It wasn't promoted. I know there was a few smaller exhibitions in the 60s. And then in 1986, there was a large exhibition on Debbie's Hill where you saw a lot of this modernist book design.
Mm-hmm.
But Carol Tiger was even though he was a leftist and he was a communist in the 1920s, or he's promoting this, he had this argument and this chasm appeared between him and the Communist Party in the around the time of the Soviet show trials. And so up until his death in the 1950s, he was quite critical, I think privately critical of the communists. And then after that, there wasn't really as much attention as should have been placed on just what a Renaissance figure he was in Czech modernist art. And then after the Velvet Revolution, MIT published a number of works. There was an exhibition at the University of Houston. I know they came out with a nice book on Czech modern art. On the cover is the Ebbets said Fairley Dickinson may have had an exhibition in the 1990s. Also, I know that Swan Gallery was quick to start auctioning off and kind of spreading the knowledge about who these people like Toyen were.
Who's Toyen?
Oh, Toyen was a fascinating figure. She was a woman artist who dressed like a man and took the name of Toyen. And I think her real name was Maria Chermakova. I should know this.
What were her dates?
She was born around 1900, and she died in the early 1980s. She emigrated to Paris in around after World War II. But she was huge. There's now a huge exhibition on her work, or there was last year. That's garnered some much more attention, international attention to her, but. She did so many of these photomontage book designs, and she would work with this other artist, Jindřich Štýrský, and some of their poetist collages are just amazing works. Yeah, she was a member of the Debbie Still group as well.
Yeah, I was just trying to get at how or if this groundbreaking book design work, magazine design work, got out and influenced the rest of the world, because I was just looking at, we haven't mentioned him yet, but Seidel, the book designer, illustrator, he was quite active in the 50s and 60s, and this was a period, late 50s, early 60s, that was really lively and bursting in Canada. One of the great book designers in Canada, his name is Frank Neufeld, and he has Czech origins. And his work is just mind-blowingly similar to Seidel's. How did they influence each other, and how did the Czech work get out around the world? Do you have any insight into that?
Oh, the 1950s and 60s. The 60s especially, I think maybe it was a little bit more easy to see what was going on. Yeah, I have the same impression with Seidel as well. You see these illustrators from Canada or France or America, and you say, wow, this is very similar. There must have been some kind of current going on there.
some kind of club, or, were there meetings? Were there design association meetings that they got together at? Or what? Or could they get out? Could the Czechs leave the country back then?
I don't know how Zdeněk Seidel got his ideas. I mean, he did, if you look at his book designs from the late 1940s to the late 1960s, this period of kind of like these caricatures, these wild designs.
Yeah,
it's
cartoonish.
Yeah, it kind of explodes in the late 50s and 60s. So
yeah,
I don't think he went everywhere. But
I'm thinking of Saul Bass, too. Mm. Those movie posters that he did, with this one, I think it's like The Man with the Golden Arm, or something like that, anyway, where there's just parts of the anatomy that are... But there's something in the air that's working, that they're all tuning into, it seems.
Zbigniew Groch conceived this Czech poster design exhibition in 2004, and you can even see it more in the Czech posters, film posters of that period. These international influences,
mm-hmm. And vice versa, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's just printed material in the 60s could come and go a little bit easier, and people were like maybe also maybe from people having immigrants, relatives, immigrants in these countries in Canada, being able to send things back and forth.
So yeah,
that's possible.
Well, you mentioned Sudnar, and again, he was a book designer, poster designer, graphic artist.
Sudnar was another just an amazing influence on Czech book design.
But he emigrated to the States in 38.
He emigrated in 38 or 39. He went to design the Czech pavilion for the World Fair in New York in 1939.
Which also drew attention to what?
Well, yeah, because the country was at that point occupied by the Nazis. And
yes.
So actually, they turned the pavilion. I know that if you see pictures of the Czech pavilion, the Czechoslovak pavilion in 1939.
Had they been thrown under the bus at that point?
Yeah, yeah.
And so this was his way of protesting that and trying to get the world to say, you know, don't do this.
Right, well, it was a protest of his country being occupied. It was a protest of, as you referred to, the Chamberlain waving this piece of paper. And I have in my hand a piece of paper, and that was supposed to guarantee world peace.
That particular line is quite resonant here, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very resonant. I once went to a wedding where the groom, who was from England, had a few too many drinks, and he stood up with a wedding certificate in his hand, and he said, "I have in my hand a piece of paper," and you could hear a pin drop. It was not the reaction he wanted.
So it's still sore.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Rightfully so. But sorry, get back to Sudnar. He was, so he turned the pavilion. It was kind of like a used to show that the country was occupied. I remember there was actually a slogan on the facade of the building about Czechoslovakia being violated and a plea for independence. I can't remember the exact wording. Sudnar then he became one of these leading typographers in America, and actually quite amazing because his English was so limited. But I know he befriended Andy Warhol in the 50s, and actually Warhol was doing some interesting typography. I think that Sudnar had a certain influence on him and his typographical works. Sudnar was doing a lot of catalogs for industrial products. He was promoting this whole idea of making the information as accessible as possible through typography. So you have information flow arrows throughout his designs. Eva Knobloch put on this exhibition in 2003, which was here just amazing cultural phenomenon. And she brought to light again what an amazing artist Sudnar was. It was, in some ways, it was a rediscovering of this chapter of typography that had been slightly ignored in this country. Also, obviously, due to the fact that Sudnar was an immigrant who didn't come back after the war.
Well, you mentioned that in the last 20 years or so, there's been an active publishing program to... I'm just so amazed that this country of 10 million have produced so many beautiful books about their graphic designers and book designers. It's just such an area, certainly in Canada, that and illustrators, you know, that hasn't really been paid much attention, but here it sure has.
Yeah, and it makes it easy for someone like me who had no training in book design. I mean, I picked it up much later in life, but to actually get into the culture, because a lot of these books are just so well presented, and they're so in depth, and the other thing about it, especially with Thomann's book, was that you have suddenly these guides to getting into areas of collection which were so immense, but you didn't know existed. It was thanks, actually, to Jindřich Thomann's book on photomontage that I was able to start to like look into putting these, or mapping it for myself in my own collection. But we were looking at the Státní nakladatelství book today, from like the works from like the late 40s to the 60s. Or actually, it's actually from the late 40s to 1995. And you're right. I mean, it's so amazing how many of these...
it's respect, isn't it?
It's a deep, deep respect for the field.
Which you don't find everywhere. By any means. I love that.
Yeah. And when you say that, I have to think.
Stephen Heller has done a heroic job of about graphic design, but I don't know. It's the depth and breadth of the coverage here is, and you know, the work that's been done is really impressive.
That's interesting you say that, because I really don't know the scenes from the other countries.
Mm-hmm. But why don't we get into, just to sort of make it a bit more practical, our conversation, let's get into, so what can people get? Like, what should they go after? If they love avant-garde, modernists, can you basically just describe what some of these things look like?
Well, of course, we talked about the photo montage. That's a large part of the...
Yeah.
And then you have more of these designs, Russian-influenced constructivist designs.
What does that look like?
Well, you have kind of these basic geometrical shapes and lines, and this idea of the beauty of this, of these basic... forms. Or in the mid-20s, you have a shift of Czech book design away from Paris and towards the east, towards Russia, and led by Taiga again.
And that's this more clean look, less cluttered.
Yeah, kind of
angular.
Like, yeah. Maybe if you think of a distilled painting, then a Lissitzky painting.
Limited palette in terms of color or not? Or... very colorful, or?
Yeah, they're very colorful. You have, one of the things we should talk about is Druzhdebny Praca, which was the Cooperative Works publisher. It was another project that Ladislav Sutnar was strongly connected to. So you have, with actually the covers themselves, the cloth covers, you would have much more of a minimalist design. And then with the wrappers, you would have either film stills used, more of like a poster of the book. The works themselves were young proletarian writers or people like Czech poetry, like you'd have Nazval, you'd have Seifert, then you'd have American works like Theodore Dreiser or Upton Sinclair. The Sutnar designs for Upton Sinclair are just amazing. You have kind of like these film stills with the logo, the Druzhdebny Praca logo, very prominent on the covers, which was also another step for Czech book design, was the idea of like promoting this uniform vision of a series and a publisher.
What films?
Well, let's see.
But would they be American films or Czech films or what?
You probably American films. So the Upton Sinclair book about the slaughterhouse. What is it?
Oh, yeah, the jungle.
The jungle. So with the jungle, you have this shocking image of a line of slaughtered pigs hanging, you know, just, but a photo, I don't know if it's from a film. And then you have the Druzhdebny Praca logo prominently on the front cover, which was DP, mm-hmm. which he had designed in this kind of symmetrical way, the D and the P. The cover itself took off the wrappers, then you'd have a very uniform, actually you have Upton Sinclair's initials intertwined on the cover, but all of the Sinclair books published by Druzhdebny Praca had the exact same design on the cover itself. So this is Sutnar's quite innovative advertising idea of promoting series, promoting publisher by easy identification of it. If you look at, I mean, Frustrante Prasa, it was revolutionary in the sense that they were trying to make these quality but inexpensive books. They actually had different versions. They had the soft covers that had this blank spine and back to make it as cheaply as possible for those who didn't have. They were really concerned with educating the working class.
Well, it's like the everyman's library. And in fact, that's what Penguin was all about, too, apparently. Or Pelican. The Pelican books were the nonfiction ones, bringing knowledge to the working man who couldn't afford or couldn't get into university.
This was the Društevní práce in Czechoslovakia. That was the publisher house that was pushing this movement here.
And when did that kick off?
Well, Sutnar took over as the artistic director of Društevní práce, I think, in 1928.
Oh, so it's prior to Penguin.
Yeah.
These were paperbacks as well as art covers?
Yeah, they were mixed. They had the paperbacks. They had the paperbacks were obviously cheap. They actually, for certain series, they would have three different versions of the paperback.
Oh, yes.
So that they could have even the most cheap available.
So they could appeal to the different levels of income.
Yeah. And then they would have the hardback, often with the front wrapper like bound in the back of it. Mm. I'm not sure if that was a Czech creation, but I haven't seen that with other books. So it wasn't.
How's that again?
So you'd have the front part of the wrapper, the original wrapper, but it would be bound at the or in front of the back end page. So you'd have the artwork if you didn't want to have it on the outside of the cover.
So it was blank.
There was no wrappers on the hardcover.
But they stuck the artwork into the back of the hardcover.
That's right. Yeah.
So that you wouldn't miss out on that.
Yeah. So you'd have it.
I don't think I've seen that before. But it's funny because you know Everett Penguin gets a lot of love for being innovative, and yet. I've just done an interview on Michelle Troy on the Albatross books out of Germany that were in English, sorry, but they covered the European continent. And Lane copied a lot of what they did. I wonder who actually started this paperback bringing intelligent material to the masses. In well-designed books.
Well, it's the same school of thought because Jan Tschichold, who designed the Penguin series, was he was definitely in contact with Ladislav Sutnar, and they mutually influenced each other.
Okay.
So he came out in the late 20s with this new typography.
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's 1929. I mean, I'm not an expert. There's a lot of people who know a lot more about European and Czech book design than I am, so I'm just kind of talking from the top of my head. But I'm sure there's correspondence between Tschichold and Sutnar, and I know that his new typography also this handbook that he came out with has Sutnar's designs in it
as an example of what
example
you should
of the proper new typography. Yeah,
that's great. So again, what I love to do is to learn about what I'm learning about right now, and then take this knowledge, take it right into the used bookstores. So if someone's thinking, I want to come over to Prague, they come here, of course, to Dan Morgan's bookstore shop.
Of course.
But if you want to work the shops in the country, what do you go after?
I would say if you want to start up a decent, unique collection of book design, then go for the photomontage from the 1930s. You can still get it in great condition at a great price.
At lots of used bookstores?
Lots of used bookstores. And you can come across some really radical stuff done by anonymous book designers, done by students. And also, I think it's worldwide, this kind of shift towards ephemera. But you can go into these.
I fell down that rabbit hole about a year ago. Yeah. I love it.
It's great. And you can get such an in into the culture through ephemera. There's still, you know, the antiquariates, the number of antiquariates is, as everywhere else in the world, it's reduced from what it was, you know, 10,
sadly,
even 5 years ago. But you can still find bookshops where you can spend an afternoon looking at uncatalogued ephemera, and you can still find great photomontage works on the shelves, and you go back, you research it, you find out that Toyin was doing it, and you kind of use it as a lead into the Czech culture.
There's no way I'm going to speak the language, but how do you use it to get into the Czech culture then?
Well, that's the thing about the Toman books, the Jindřich Toman books, they're published in English.
By Kant,
yeah.
I love that. Yeah. Apparently that's a one-man show.
Yeah, he's done amazing works to help people understand Czech book design. So you don't really need Czech language. I mean, minimum level of Czech language will help you immensely. But these books have really mapped out the modernist book design to such an extent that you read the book and then you know what to look for.
Right.
And there's other areas. I mean, we were looking at the Seidel designs that you picked up. What did you picked it up for like 60 crowns, which is about $3. A beautiful book from the 60s. They're such a large print run that they are, they're available, but
still gorgeous. It's
gorgeous. You find it in great condition, and you can have this great collection from the 50s and 60s of this, what they call it, like the second wave of modernist book design in this country, because the mid-1950s was pretty bleak from my view of Czech book design. And then you kind of had this openness, this thawing of the culture after the denunciation of Stalin. I don't know if it was directly correlated, but then you have designs by Seidel, which are so wild compared to these, what was being designed 5 years prior to that.
There's something about that 55 to 65 period that expresses itself all around the world in book design. It's really an exciting time. Yeah, I don't necessarily get into why, but you mentioned this publishing house. That sounds pretty cool to go after that.
Yeah, that's a great idea, because it's Družstevní práce was so readily available, and so many people still have it in their own private libraries, and you can get these gorgeous covers by Ladislav Sutnar,
Did you do any of them?
Čapek worked for Družstevní práce as well. Mm-hmm. Josef Čapek, that's another line of collection. I know that there are some Japanese collectors who just love Čapek.
Well, yes, apparently they put his images on everything over there, like keychains and pillows and such.
Yeah, and I think they had one of the earliest translations of Josef Čapek's brother Karol Čapek's R.U.R. The person to talk to is actually Zbigniew Groch, because he was over in Japan. He has this great story of going to the fair in Japan and meeting a collector and being invited back to the collector's house and going to basically the shrine of Čapek's works.
And who would have thought?
Yeah, being like taken down to this room, and then Groch just like looking and realizing that most of the books came from his shop.
You mean they were just shopping and he didn't know it?
I guess maybe there was somebody who was buying them and then
for him, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Selling them to this Japanese collector.
I love that too, that there's interest from around the world. They're revered, these people, you know.
Yeah.
These designers. And as I say, that gets to my question about how influential they were. Obviously, you know, when you see quality, anyone around the world sees quality work, like they're drawn to it.
I think that's it. One of the earlier buyers, and I think he was even here before the Velvet Revolution, buying up lots of Czech avant-garde, was Vlomens. I think they're in Amsterdam.
That's a bookseller who had an eye for this?
He had an eye for this, and he was coming in his car here in the late 80s and just buying up a lot of, he didn't know any Czech.
No. Well, that's the nice thing about book design. It's yeah. And again, I don't know Spanish, but I know that there's some book designers that I can recognize and buy without understanding the language. And that's what's so cool about this field, isn't it?
That's right. And there was an exhibition of his collection, or one of his collections of Czech book design in Dresden recently, like 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little video of him talking about, you know, how he acquired these books. And he made a comment that I'll never forget. He said, actually, I thought they were funny, but they were just so visually appealing. I had no idea what they meant. He didn't know really what Carol Tyga was doing because there weren't any books about Tyga at that time. But he just had an eye that this was an impressive avant-garde moment in book design, and he bought up as much as he could.
That's so smart.
Yeah.
And but it does speak to this, the importance of trusting your intuition about what you think is interesting. That's what a collector has to do.
Absolutely. That's actually my meager collection I have. Most of my books are, you know, you can get for $4 or $5. I've kind of changed over from the collector of, because I don't collect to as an investment anymore. I just collect for what is visually striking, which I like to pick up and take a look at. And so I've got like 10 books which I'm not going to sell. I just like them because I find them incredibly unique.
Mm. Well, and pleasing just to spend a bit of time with, right?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, and that's all another area of collection. You can just have a nice, inexpensive collection of designs which are aesthetically appealing to you.
Yeah. That speak to you. Mm-hmm. Have we covered the terrain adequately? Is there anyone that we haven't talked about?
In Czech book design, oh God, there's so many areas.
Well, the modernist, let's say, the one that you focus on.
There's an interesting book designer who was prolific from, and I think he's one of the few that was prolific during the first avant-garde wave. He started in the late 20s. He went through into the 1960s, and that was Jaroslav Schwab. It's fascinating because it's another one of these designers whose books are so easy to find, and you can find them in really good condition. But it's a great collection to have because you see the lines of influence from the 1930s and 40s to then the 1960s. With him, you see it in one book designer, where you can see people like Bohumil Stepan. Stepan was a designer of the 1960s, and he really went into this photo montage adopted from the 1930s, except he did it in a much more humorous way. So that's another area, sort of mid-late 60s, absurdist designs. Bohumil Stepan was, I think it's actually Stepan. I'm not sure if it's Stepan or Stepan, but he was doing witty designs at the time.
Absurdist in the sense that you were being governed by a completely absurd mentality.
Sure, yeah. And that came to an end in kind of 69. After the tanks rolled in, he did the designs for a number of periodicals, which were kind of satirical periodicals in late 1960s. It's slipping my mind right now, the periodical. But so you'd have real kind of shocking photo montages of like a woman with, where her breast should be, there was a butt.
Sounds like Monty Python.
It was very much like Monty Python, actually. Yeah, now that you say that, it was very much like this cartoon of the big foot coming down and, you know,
just making a fart sound.
Yeah, and, you know, people like intellectuals were all publishing in this because it was such a time where the press was so liberal of, like, from 66 to 68 that you had, like, Václav Havel publishing, you know, his these kind of absurdist articles, and it was very light, but not actually his, but a lot of the articles in these publications were kind of poking fun at the communist systems and the social situation. And so, yeah, and that was also sort of tied to this absurdist book design.
We focused on cubism, and you mentioned poetism. Did abstract expressionism have any
more
influence, or like it
more in the illustrations and woodcuts, I would say, than the designs and the covers themselves?
Yeah, so it really was cubism then, would you say?
Yeah, but there's definitely influences of expressionism, and in fact, sometimes I use the term cubist expressionist cover because you have definitely elements of both.
Yeah, that's the thing. You can't pigeonhole this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, even the cubism itself is, there are people who object to it as a misnomer, that it should actually be angular style because it's not sort of in the Picasso sense of a cubist painting these, but much more in the idea of this cubist architecture.
But it's two-dimensional. I mean, it's flattened out, right?
Yeah. But, yeah. Kind of like flattened out cubist architecture.
Well, I'm pretty keen to hit the bookstores with this newfound knowledge now. Again, we did a bit of that, but I want to find some of this stuff. And well, I hopped over to Krakow for the weekend and found some interesting stuff from the early 30s, the magazine. What was it called again? Teska?
Teska, yeah. Those are stunning. Those are really nice.
And again, it's just like, I'm no expert, but I just went with, hey, that looks really great, and it's not expensive, and it deserves to be preserved and researched, you know.
That's the joy of book collecting. I think that's important also to have a shop where you can find these gems.
That's what you're doing. You're gathering it together for people, right?
Well, I've got rare works which are highly priced, but I also have, I kind of learned this from my aunt, Edie, who has a bookstore in Upper State New York called The Owl Pen. And
it's for sale, right?
It's for sale. I think possibly it's already sold. Or it's in the process of being sold. But
okay.
She would always have this system of having gems, I mean, deliberately putting gems within her books so that people can find these.
So good.
Yeah.
And price it so that the person that buys it thinks and knows they're getting a really good deal because they'll tell everyone about it.
Exactly, yeah. So I've tried to implement that, my dear Aunt Edie's system here. So there's definitely some avant-garde gems in here that you'll find at a really surprisingly low price.
Well, I know what I'm going to be doing for the next half an hour then. Anything else do you want to say to the hordes of bookish types that are listening?
I was going to ask you, I mean, is Krakow, are there used bookstores like in the center of the city? Because Prague is still pretty amazing that you could find, we went for a walk and we hit like four or five right in the center of the city. Is that how?
Yes. I hit three plus this new bookstore that claims to be the oldest bookstore in the world, set up in 1610. That's right on the main market square. But yeah, I found a couple stores that were really, really interesting. And in fact, I got a book called, I think it's called Very Graphic or something like that. I can't recall who edited it, but he teaches at Rhode Island. And it's a sort of compilation of essays and profiles of a ton of Polish graphic designers and book designers. So I got that, and I got the magazine. So definitely worth a trip there, because there are, in that center area, there are probably five or six.
I'm going to have to get there. I've lived here for 25 years, and to my shame, I've never been to Krakow.
Yeah, I would say for a book lover, it's a good place to hit for sure. Yeah. Very good.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Dan. It's just very pleasant sitting in this space of yours, carpeted space with a little courtyard in the back, right?
Yeah, which is now filled up by roofing material. They're repairing the roof, but I talked to the workers. I said, we're going to do the roof from January to April, which in Czech parlance means sometime next year.
Well, very good. So listeners can look forward to coming here and admiring the new roof and the books. And so how do they find you, Dan?
Well, you can just come to the address and ring the doorbell. I'm here every day
What's
at
the address?
Verdunska Street, number 23. Or you can call my number. It's on my webpage.
And what's your web page?
It's morganbooks.eu. And if you want, also send out a list of new arrivals every month, so you can just write your email and I'll add you to the list. And also, we have a cultural evening here. It's called Tuesday at 6 p.m. And
That's what it's called.
yeah, this is quite
That's good. That's
creative
very
name. Actually, it's called Tuesday at six.
no.
So
And it's on Wednesdays, is it?
yeah. So you can show up at Tuesday at six. And we're officially open to the public on Tuesdays, but if you ring the doorbell twice, then you can get in with a secret bell ringing of two times anytime you want.
Wonderful. Well, thanks again for taking the time to talk. It's been delightful.
Thanks, Nigel.